Welcome to GreenAg Scandinavia and the second episode with the sustainability advisor Mattias Goldman. We will get his view on the biggest trends within the sustainability area, his three biggest takeaways from COP26, and tips on how you and I can make the difference. From your perspective, what are the big trends that you see within the sustainability area?
I'm very glad when I look at COP26 that we finally realize that climate is about mitigation, so reducing emissions, and adaptation. Unfortunately, we overslept, so we have to also adapt to a changing climate, and that is very real and very close to heart for billions of people around this planet. So that's a big trend, that adaptation is up. I believe that also has to do with that we've all seen the wildfires and the extreme heat and the storms and so forth. Another thing that I believe, and it's a sort of between what I see and what I hope. So you correct me if you don't agree, but I start seeing that we realize that we cannot combat one sustainability issue at a time. Because fairly often when we worked to combat climate change, it has not been great for biodiversity, for instance. We get monocultures of forest for biomass, for instance, or many other examples of how different SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals, have created unfortunate trade-offs. And we need to be able to factor in more than one of them at a time. In fact, very often, even the mitigation and adaptation that I just mentioned often are at loggerheads. So when you do climate adaptation, for instance, if you go to Slussen in Stockholm and you see how we protect ourselves from rising seawater levels that would come into Mälaren, where we have our fresh water for drinking, we put up a lot of concrete to stop the seawater from coming into the fresh water. And a lot of concrete is terrible for climate, so we have a vicious circle of the more adaptation we do, the worse the climate, and the more adaptation we have to do. Whereas here in Thailand, the other day I visited the rehabilitation of a mangrove forest, which is climate adaptation. It helps protect against more violent storms. And it's also great for reducing emissions because it takes up, it sequestrates carbon from the atmosphere. So there we have a positive circle. So we need to break those vicious circles where adaptation and mitigation fight each other, or where different SDGs fight each other. And there's great examples around, but there's also a lot of examples where we only focus on one of these issues at a time. That's not good enough.
I agree in the terms that I see also that more voices are raised in terms of the biodiversity area, but I feel that it's not enough, that it's not quick enough.
Yes. It's true, also because when we look at many of the other SDGs and we ask the different United Nations special branches for them, we ask, for instance, well, if we want to combat hunger and poverty, the SDG number 1 and 2, what are the most important things? And then the UNDP, United Nations Development Program, says, well, first of all, we need to combat climate change. Otherwise, there's no way we're going to meet those targets. And we ask the experts on biodiversity, should we have more national parks and reserves? And they say, well, that's a good idea, but it won't help unless we combat climate change. So clearly, combating climate change is sort of the domino brick that has to fall in the right direction for the others to be able to fall. It doesn't mean that we've solved the others, but if we fail on climate change, we will fail on all the others as well.
But don't we need to work in parallel there? That yes. We take all these actions now, because we don't really have time to first do one thing and then do the next thing. See what I mean?
You're right, because you mentioned the Swedish 2045 targets, but most of the climate targets that we have are for 2030, and that's when the science-based target says that we have to halve our emissions compared to now. And 2030 is also the year when we've, as a world, agreed that we're to reach the 17 Sustainability Development Goals, which include eradicating extreme poverty and zero hunger in the world and so forth. So you're right, we can't work with one at a time. And the great thing is that when we focus on more than one, it also opens up our minds to see solutions that we would not see if we only work at one conference with poverty and then only work at another summit with climate, for instance. There's a 1 + 1 = 3 sometimes.
From your perspective, what would you like to conclude of what happened during COP26 in terms of limiting the greenhouse gas emissions?
I think that COP26 perhaps gave us three main things. One, which I already touched upon, was the realization that we need to act better in terms of adaptation as well. The second one was that for the first time ever, we specifically mentioned some of the things that are clearly not compatible with a climate-friendly world, specifically coal and subsidies for fossil fuels. It's not enough, but it's a start that it's there in writing. And thirdly, the COP themselves. Every country has a veto, which means that the country that wants the least decides the most. And that is why it's so exciting to see all the initiatives immediately adjacent to the COPs, but not technically formally part of the COPs. And we had several incredible, great different coalitions that were formed there with zero global deforestation 2030, 30% methane reduction for 2030, 100% electric vehicles 2035, if I don't get the numbers wrong, for our parts of the world, and 2045 for the rest of the world. And several other great coalitions, many of them gathering more than 100 countries and also large enterprises and municipalities in these sort of ever-growing coalitions of the willing. So this would be my top three. So a more formal answer would be that finally, 6 years after the Paris Agreement, we've got the rule book for the Paris Agreement in place. And that means that we can move further, faster together.
What do you feel about the nationally determined contributions? What are the enablers to reach the climate targets in accordance to the Paris Agreement, if you think about the nationally determined contributions?
I think about them a lot because they are easier to read and understand than many people realize. You find them at the UNFCCC website, and that is what each and every country in the world has promised to do to combat climate change. It's a great read when you want to have business with a country, when you want to start living there, as in my case, or so forth. And when you look at these NDCs, first of all, they prove that the Paris Agreement delivered, because the Paris Agreement said 6 years ago, every country has to have an NDC, a nationally determined contribution. And basically, you could put pretty much anything in there, and countries did. But then it said that every 5 years, it's time for enhanced action. And because there was no COP last year, this was the first time for us to have those enhanced action. And we did see enhanced action. India, for the first time ever, pledged climate neutrality 2070. China, first time ever, 2060. US, first time ever, 2050. Japan, 2050. South Korea, 2050. The EU, 2050. Sweden, as you mentioned, 2045. Even Thailand, where I am now, pledged 2050 for the first time. Now, is that enough? No. But it's a great step ahead, and it's amazing to see that in the discussion, whether these enhanced actions should take place every 5 years or every 10 years, the answer was that already next year, we need to up our ante, we need to come back with stronger pledges so that the 1.5 degree target is kept alive, because with the NDCs that we have until now, we are way above 2 degrees of warming, and we need to realize that it's far from certain that those promises are going to be fully kept either.
Mm. And what are your feelings about, you know, countries setting the climate neutral targets to 2050 and 2070 and even Sweden 2045? Is that enough? It sounds like it's so far away.
You know, I'm not incredibly impressed with politicians setting tough targets for some time long after they're out of office and perhaps even dead and gone. What impresses me is if I start seeing action plans and short-term targets and true things happening on the ground. Here in Thailand, just as an example, they pledged 2050. that's far off. But then they also said, well, we're going to start with the energy and transport sector, 2035, 100% electric vehicles. And just yesterday, the incentives for starting to make that happen came into place. And that is comes back to the nudging that you mentioned a while ago, Pernilla. If we just say, well, these pledges, 2070, 2060, 2045, that's so far away, so it doesn't matter. It's not going to matter. But if we say, let's see the action plan, let's see the first steps, how does that slope down to 2045 look like? And the slope is super important because you can reach zero 2045 by going full speed ahead until 2044 and then do all the emissions reductions the last year. Or you can have an even reduction throughout the years, or you can start out big and then have sort of a remaining part at the end. And for the climate, which way you want to reach your target makes a huge difference, because the accumulated carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is obviously much, much more if everybody chooses to wait with their concrete actions. And that's where we need to nudge and pressure that we want to see these things happening now. Unfortunately, Sweden and many other countries have started realizing that at least in parts of the emissions reductions, there's a competitive advantage to being the first mover. We start seeing that if Sweden will truly be the world's first manufacturer at scale of fossil-free steel, of carbon-neutral cement, and so forth, it's going to bring business money to us. It's going to bring more money to the pensions when you and I retire.
And you used to be in the politics as well, right?
Yes.
Why are you not there now? Like, what made you go from the politics into the corporate world?
So first, there's eight in the Swedish parliament. There's eight parties. One of them I don't share many views with. The other seven, I want to give a big virtual hug to all of the representatives of these parties. We have different opinions on many things. I often criticize, I believe, all of those parties, but being elected is a beautiful thing and a tough job, often very unpopular and not as well paid as many people think. And you don't have much free time and you don't have much personal life left if you go into public office, which is often very public. I was with the Green Party. It's important for me now to be not linked to any party, because I want to be able to discuss with all the seven parties that agreed to the Swedish climate target. If you didn't agree to the target, there's not so much point in discussing with you. But these seven parties from the left to the conservatives agreed. So I'm excited about discussing with them. And that would be hard if I had one party logo on my forehead. But I also left because I think that, party politics aside, I think that the Green Party has a point in the fact that one should not be a politician for life. I would encourage everyone to try and seek office somewhere. It can be a local commission and milieu and whatever in your municipality. It can be bigger than that. But throughout my career after that, I have daily use of all the knowledge that I gained on how decisions are really taken, and also a network that's tremendously useful. But it was more. But I can make a bigger difference when I'm not linked to any one specific party. And it also became harder and harder for me to always say that one party is right and all the parties are always wrong. I think that's simply not true. I admire those who can, with a straight face, say that my party's solution is always the right one. But I realize that also many others who have left party politics say that we should be better at listening to each other and finding agreements. And specifically for Sweden, I think that the last years in politics have been very hard on everyone. But they've also shown the beauty of having to sit down and discuss and give and take. And I'm convinced that the way forward will very often be that we have to do more of give and take.
So do you feel that you can impact more now working as a sustainability advisor?
I've always it's a question I keep posing myself, and in fact I was sitting with a monk in Thailand the other week asking a monk, how can I make the biggest difference? And the monk said something wise. Maybe they have like wise one-liners that they always use, but he said it's got to begin with yourself. If you feel that this is not your true self, it will never work. And so that was my primary reason for giving up politics. I simply could not continue to with a straight face saying that this party is always right. But then after that, I've been thinking, okay, so as a lobbyist, was that the most efficient? I was named lobbyist of the year, so I had some influence, but still you're at the mercy of those paying your bills, right? Then I went small-scale NGO, and I went think tank, and I went large corporate on the stock market company. And now I do individual consulting. And I would struggle to say which one has been the most efficient for me. I think the combination. And I think that's the answer to many people who ask me for career advice. I say like the monk, find what's good for you, but try and not stick to any one sector forever. Because I feel that having been in the NGO sector really helps me when I talk to politicians. Having been in commercial business, strictly commercial, with quarter reports and everything, really helps me when I discuss with NGOs where very few of them have any commercial experience. So trying to get a little bit of each part of the cake makes you more, generally speaking, would make you more relevant for the questions that you want to try and push.
Do you have any other advice for people wanting to make a difference at the workplace?
So we did a study at the think tank Fores about what really made a difference in terms of combating climate change. So we compared municipalities to try and find what were the common denominator about the really good ones. And it was not which parties were governing. It was not whether the municipality was big or small. It was not whether it was rich or poor. It was about people. And it was not necessarily about the mayor or the very most important politicians. It was often middle management people like you and I, who were not necessarily given the mandate, they just took the mandate. They just insisted on bringing up the issue at every meeting, or they insisted on going out of their way to find ways to get funding for projects, which is always popular with politics. If you can get some money for stuff, that's more easy to get through. But yeah, so that was in a sense it was a disappointment, because we wanted to have almost like a chemical reaction. If you do this and this, it's going to be climate leadership. But in another sense, it was a great message, because if those people that we found as climate leaders could, Pernilla, Matthias, and many others can as well. It's about just deciding to be part of the solution.
As we mentioned before, Sweden is to be a climate neutral country by year 2045. How do you foresee that our everyday life will look like year 2045?
Oh, I'm sorry to ruin your pod here, but I think it's gonna look a bit the same. I think that if we go back 25 years, we're gonna be then in 1998, and most of the workplaces then still exist. Most of the modes of transport still exist, and so forth. And if we leap as much forward, it's gonna be of course cars are not gonna be powered by fossil fuels. That's so incredibly stupid. Of course, all the energy is gonna be renewable. Of course, it's going to be faster to go between Stockholm and Gothenburg than it is now. But the basic ways that we still work, hopefully a little bit less than 8 hours or 10 hours in my case a day, but still physically work mostly the way we do now, still transport ourselves in something that resembles the way we do now, but much cleaner. Where I'm worried is that it's incredibly important for us to quickly reduce our emissions, and by a lot, but it's also important for us to keep this world an open place. And I'm worried that many of us will jump to the conclusion that we should have everything nearby. That we should stick to our own neighborhoods. There's this vision of the 15-minute city, for instance, which would mean, in the case of Stockholm, that the people from Östermalm never meet the people from Rinkeby. And it would meet, of course, it would mean that nobody ever meets anyone from Thailand or a different culture or a different religion. And I think that goes back to what we talked a little bit about earlier, how it's important to not focus on just one of the sustainability challenges that we had in front of us. And I would hate it if people like me unwillingly become part of a more closed society and in fact, you know, are the helpful idiots that help those xenophobic, almost racist powers out there who say that we should isolate each other more, isolate more from each other. And that's being fueled already by the fear of COVID and probably other future diseases, which means that it's important for me that the climate challenge remains a combat also for an open society.
What do you think are the biggest challenges for us reaching the Paris Agreement, our climate targets, limiting the warming?
I think we already mentioned several of them. Number one, I would say the one that you also pointed out, it's habits are very strong and we need to break some habits here. But my emphasis is on minimizing the picture of that habit to make people feel comfortable about the change. Everything is going to be the same. It's just going to be done in a smarter way. You can still go to Gothenburg, just not by the plane. The second one is that the established industries always have the strongest lobbyists. And we are now seeing that it's a matter of life and death for the coal industry, the gas industry, the oil industry, and so forth. And they are just now having a global oil conference where they are confident that with technologies for cleaner oil, they will be able to furnish oil in the future as well. No. We have to let go of the fossil fuels, and that is going to be a very hard fight. And these are enemies that are going to use all the weapons that they have because it's a fight for survival. And the third one is a question about global justice, which springs to mind when we see how little money we in the developed world have been prepared to put forward when it comes to combating climate change and the effects of climate change in developing countries. They suffer the most. They didn't cost it very much. We cost it by and large, but we don't even live up to those very meager promises of international climate financing, while every day we spend more on the army or on protecting ourselves from COVID than we do in a year. In climate protection.
Have you gotten any new perspectives on the state of the climate and biodiversity since you moved to Asia?
Yes, I believe that this perspective helps me better understand what a typical global citizen looks like. Most global citizens are not rich like you and I. Or like an average Scandinavian, but they're not also dirt poor like when I used to live in Kenya on the countryside there. They're fairly well off, but they fight hard for their daily lives. And so that gives me a perspective of what chances do we have to say that we need to completely change our lifestyles. Very little in the global perspective. When it comes to biodiversity and climate adaptation, Thailand is the number 9 most vulnerable country in the world because it's low-lying. Bangkok will be gone by 2050, 2060 if current seawater rises continue. And long before that, the staple food here, rice, may also be gone. Which means that this is very clearly not just something about whether you want a wall to be built in Höllvik and Skanöfalsterbo Vellinge or not. It's your basic income, your housing, everything is under threat. Which means that the urgency that we sometimes might not necessarily feel in our parts of the world. Mm. We might also feel that, well, I have some money in my bank account, or I have inheritances coming up. I might be able to pay my way out of the worst of this. This is certainly another feeling that most people have around the planet. And one thing that I like about the Swedish climate target, okay, 2045 is not as radical as it sounded when it was decided, which is a great thing. We move fast now on climate issues. We're no longer impressed with 2045, but I'm impressed with the way that these seven parties could agree, because, you know, they fight and bicker on everything, but when it really matters, they could actually decide on a joint target. And whatever happened in Swedish politics after that, and it's been chaotic, the target still stands. And the most important part of this target is the realization that when Sweden is only accountable for 0.15% of global emissions, our way to really make a difference is to be the shining example for others. And I'm not saying that we necessarily are. In fact, we're not. In many cases, we're not. But the struggle to become that leadership, that sort of, if you want, permanent exhibition for climate-friendly solutions or global help desk for climate answers, that is something that I see many countries around the world asking us to do. Because they said, well, you were the pioneer in destroying this place. Now we ask you to step up and be the pioneer in fixing it as well.
So Sweden has an important role there to be, can be a role model for others.
And that's so great, because Sweden is a tiny country. It's you and I and just 10 million others. And when Sweden wants to be a role model, we're not like North Korea, that everybody walks in this exact same speed. So in Sweden, somebody has to be the role model within Sweden. And it's been exciting to see how some of these positions are being taken. For instance, me and the former climate minister, Per Bolund, we inaugurated the Church of Huddinge's decision to be the green church. You know, most churches still get their power from underneath. Strange for a church, right? This was the first one to get all of the power from above, which any church should. And they said, they literally said that if everyone should look at Sweden, then every church should look at a church in Sweden, and we want to be that one. And it's hard for me because I am a Hammarby supporter, but Malmö FF, which won the Swedish football championship the other day, they said, well, then every football club should look at a football club somewhere in Sweden, and we want to be that one. And they work really well with joining the different sustainable development goals. Lidl, the daily food store, said the same thing. If everybody should look at them, they should look at us. And their shop in Visby is the world's first climate positive shop, which has people from the global legal community looking at and copying and hopefully improving upon. But those are my three examples. I don't have any more. So for most sectors, there's still not anyone who's raised their hand and said, well, I am the one within my sector that everybody should look at. And when you do that, you become relevant way beyond your own niche, your own sector, your own municipality. You might become globally relevant. And that's where I sort of look myself in the mirror with pride of being Swedish, because it gives us all an opportunity to be globally relevant.
Well, to conclude this episode, I wonder if you can give three pro tips on how you and I and everyone in our everyday lives can contribute to reach climate neutral future and also increase biodiversity.
I'm glad that you combined them. My three proposals are going to be fairly general, because I know that you reach out to a large and diverse audience. Number one is going to be start with yourself, but with the things that you love doing, and share them, not with the ones that make you suffer, but be sure that you brag, because I'm worried about greenwash, but I'm as worried, if not more, of green hush. People not telling all the great things they're doing for climate and biodiversity.
Is that green hush?
Green hush.
I haven't heard of that.
Especially companies are super worried, because they're worried that somebody like me will just say, well, that's not good enough. And of course, rarely it is good enough, but a step in the right direction is a step in the right direction and should be applauded, because when we applaud it, it will be followed by others. It's like the kids taking their first steps. It looks ugly. It's not good enough. They might trip. They might fall. But we still say, wow, great. We're super proud, right? And that encourages them to do more. Well, that was number one. Number two is that don't let the politicians get away with this, because we can only do so much as citizens or nudgers. When we are to reach a climate neutral society, it, by and large, the big decisions, they are political. And if I had still been an elected politician, I would love for the discussion to focus so much about you and I as individuals. But the big thing we can do is put political pressure on whichever party we vote for. And as a former elected, I know how very few fairly normal people reach out to politicians. It's only the interest organizations and all those paid lobbyists. But if you just as you contact politicians, chances are that you will be the only one that day or even that week that reached out with a concrete proposal. And I love for that to be promises rather than in Swedish, löftesleverantör rather than kravmaskin. If you can help the politicians keep their promises, then you're extra relevant. And number three is exactly what you're doing, Pernilla, that see every opportunity to be part of the future world that we want to see. You might be part of a podcast, you might be part of a dinner conversation, you might stand in the queue waiting to pay your grocery. There's always an opportunity, and I know that we can't always do that. It gets tiresome. But just do it one more time this week, and then two more times next week, so that the bus is about that we want to really meet those climate targets and the opportunity that you and I have. This is the generation, this is the only time in the history of humankind where we can really decide the future. What a great opportunity. Let's not miss out on that one.
Well said, well said. Thank you so much, Matthias.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you so much for the great work that you do with the Green Hacks podcast. I encourage everyone who's listened to this one to backtrack and listen to the other ones like I did prior to this show.